everybody, we're live. John is hacking up a lung over here.
Yeah, John is very unwell, and I didn't find this out, or we didn't find this out until, I don't know, 2 minutes ago. So if this episode is only 15 minutes long, it's because we're taking pity on our good friend. And if it's hugely long, then it's like every time I feel unwell. So we'll see what happens.
I can do a normal length episode, but I'm at like half power now. Like I said, I was worse last night. And for the bootleg people who are wondering, my COVID tests continue to come back negative. These are fresh, non-expired, freshly bought COVID tests. Apparently, it's just plain not COVID. It's just a cold, but it is a
doozy,
very
cold,
annoying and stubborn cold that does involve a small amount of fever, and I'm not liking it, but I'm here.
Well, we'll take advantage of your brain being slightly melting and you know, we'll go over things like the right way to pronounce Mario, which one of us actually lives on Long Island, and which, all sorts of fun issues like that.
Maybe we should just call it Mario and say you live in Long Island. Just I know it messes with you too, but it would really mess with John.
It's worth it.
Casey wants to make the maximum number of people angry.
All right. Do we want to do some pre-show?
So, well, that we just did.
Oh, that was okay. Good.
Yeah, I mean, you got to actually do the thing. I don't
So we're doing the St. Jude, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
We're done. Okay. I just want to make sure if that's the pre-show, then I can start it.
Please,
all right.
Please donate.
Okay. All right. So, it is September, which it means it's Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. I feel like I didn't pronounce any of that with all the letters and the words, but here we go. We're doing it live. So I'm going to vamp while I pull up the official ad read and tell you that, hey, there are a lot of children that are unwell, and that's not okay. And a lot of them have some flavor of cancer, and that is also not okay. And so we are part of Relay, and we're also partnering with Relay. We're partnering with ourselves. I don't know. You just go with it. So we, Relay, have raised over $3 million over the last 5 years, starting in 2019. It's bananas. It's absolutely bananas. And because of that, Relay is going to have their name put on like this. It's more than a plaque, but put on like this board in the St. Jude campus for all the corporate and personal donors that have done, just gone above and beyond. And that's so super incredibly cool. And so what we are doing is we're trying to raise money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. St. Jude does incredible, phenomenal work, and they do it in such a way that it affects people all over the world. So St. Jude is headquartered in Memphis, Tennessee. I will be there in a couple of weeks when Relay does their 12-hour podcast-a-thon. You can watch me melt into a puddle over the course of those 12 hours as I do everything I can to raise more money for these sick children. But here's the thing. St. Jude has treated children from all 50 states and around the world. 90% of the children at risk of developing cancer live in low and middle income countries. That is unacceptable to St. Jude. And you know what? It's unacceptable to us. So that's why St. Jude launched St. Jude Global. That way, every child with cancer, no matter where they live, and also other catastrophic diseases, by the way, they have access to quality care and treatment. So when I was at St. Jude in April for the Play Live Summit, they brought several different people on stage, and some of them were survivors in St. Jude patients. Some of them were family members. And the number of stories that we saw, but actually not just on stage, but just in general with the people we met, the number of stories we saw where it was something along the lines of, I am in some foreign country. I have done everything that my country knows how to do with regard to either my cancer, my child's cancer, or my brother's cancer. And we were at wit's end. I mean, we were basically given a death sentence. And then somebody thought, you know, let's call St. Jude. Let's see what happens. And the number of stories that, you know, there's all these different ways these stories started that somehow or another involved really dire circumstances. But every single one of them ended with, we called St. Jude, and within hours, we had plane tickets to go to Memphis, Tennessee, and they didn't have to pay for it at all because St. Jude pays for it all. So in order for St. Jude to pay for all these things, we ask for you to donate whatever you can. And actually, live on air in just a minute, we will have my favorite and least favorite moment of the year when I somehow ruin my donation and it becomes a joke for the next year. So we're going to do that in a minute. But hey, there's one other reason you might want to donate, or one other excuse perhaps to donate, one other just a justification for donation, and I like to call it the Marco offset. Marco, can you tell me what the offset is, please?
Yes. Starting probably next week, many of you out there are going to be buying new Apple products. You might have even bought some other things recently, possibly the new Android folding things. Maybe I saw there was a new Remarkable tablet today that looks really cool. All sorts of fun gadgets launching in this gadget season. And you probably don't necessarily need to spend money on new gadgets. Maybe you got something broken that needs to be replaced. But for the most part, we all know that this is like, these are mostly luxuries that we have that were because we're very fortunate to be able to afford nice electronics for many of us listening to this podcast. Now, when you buy your nice electronics that you don't really maybe need, but you're buying because you want a treat and they're fun and they're awesome, you tend to purchase other things at the same time. Things like a case or additional storage upgrades or a keyboard or some other kind of accessory for the thing that you're buying. You even also do things like, you know, Apple Care, you know, warranty services, or you certainly almost, you know, almost always in most places you have to pay sales tax. So you have all these kind of add-on fees and upgrades and accessories and taxes to the thing you are buying. I suggest when thinking about what your minimum donation to St. Jude should be, add up all those extras that you tack on to your purchase or purchases, including all the taxes, all the storage upgrades, all the accessories and cases and warranties and all that stuff. Add up all that. That should be your target minimum donation to St. Jude if you can swing it. And fortunately for us and for most of you out there, many of you out there are able to swing it, and that's great. And this is how you can assuage some of your guilt about these new tech products that you're buying by giving a nice chunk of money, if you can, to St. Jude.
Yep. So here's the thing. When we rally for a common cause, we become more than a community. We become beacons of hope for all. Yes, that is a little bit silly, but it's true. It's really true. So please join Relay and ATP and donate to St. Jude this September for Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. You can go to stjude.org/ATP to just go straight to the donation area, which is what we're about to do, the three of us. Or if you want more information, or if you perhaps want to start your own like campaign, you can go to stjude.org/relay. So stjude.org/ATP to just go straight to the donation. So now the three of us are going to do our annual donations. And here's the thing. We always say we're going to do the gentlemanly thing of agreeing on exactly how much we're going to donate. And I believe, as with past years, we had agreed on $7,000, but we can never do that because we're all just difficult. So the question is, who is going to be the winner by donating the most, but also sticking to the gentlemanly agreement of $7,000. So in past years, I should have looked this up. In past years, I think I've done $7,001 or $7,001. I feel like that isn't enough, but I want to stick close to the $7,000. And so I am going to, as we speak, I'm going to say payment details. I'm going to see if I can Apple Pay this. And I'm not going to tell you quite yet exactly what I am going to do. Oh, I have to add an address. My mistake. You're going to have to wait while I do that. But my thinking is that I need to do just a little bit more. I'm hoping that's not a bad choice. And I probably shouldn't be telling you this while I'm on air, because now Marco is probably just tripling his donation, which honestly,
I've already hit my button. I hit it while you were talking already. So it's
All right. I should look, but I'm not going to. I haven't looked yet. All right. I'm hitting the Apple Pay button,
Marco,
right now. All right. And I'm paying to Touch ID. All right. Thinking, processing, payment, processing. Done.
Bling.
I donated $7,001.43 because 143 is short for I love you. One letter, four Aww. Letters, three letters. And that's for Aaron. And so if we lost, it's really you being mean to Aaron is what's going on. So let's see how we do.
You definitely talk too much this year, Casey. You're incredibly bad at this game. And I basically conceded this game because what's his name? Adrian Veidt or whatever. I made my donation 35 minutes ago because
gosh.
I thought we were doing it before we started airing. So you could have just looked and seen the amount that I did.
I didn't, but I want to be honest about it.
I didn't look.
Marco has just decided he's sick of losing this game.
Yeah, right? Seriously. Marco has decided enough is enough.
I have lost
enough
every
is
year.
Enough.
Right. So, I mean, fair enough. Like this year, I was trying to give Casey a chance to win this year, but apparently Casey cannot be helped.
Wait, why? Where did 17 come from?
I did 11 last year.
Oh my gosh. So the final donations from ATP, me and Aaron coming in last at $7,001.43. Then John Syracusa at $7,017 even. And then Marco and Tiff swooping in to take the lead, comfortably take the lead, I should add. Marco, how much did you two donate?
7,777.77.
Well done. That's very alliterative.
I feel like Marco was, again, it's a technical foul on massively exceeding the amount, but because it's for a charitable cause and because he had never won before, we're going to let it slide this time. But we can't support this kind of inflation.
Yeah, this is awfully large inflation. I mean, this is ridiculous. It shall not stand.
Collectively, ATP has donated, according to my little calculator here, $21,796.20. Of course, that exact amount is what we would do, but that's what we ended up at. By the way, I have to say that this is obviously, it's a Relay Pledge drive, and we have Relay podcasts, and we are Relay adjacent. We are friends with them, but I've always been proud of how much of the Relay Pledge drive is from listeners to a non-Relay podcast. ATP listeners donate tons of money. Like, we already talked about the leaderboard thing we have for Casey's stickers or whatever, where the ATP listeners with large means put huge donations in for the chance of getting those stickers, right? Sometimes people put ATP in their comments or whatever. We've been amazed by how much money and how generous ATP listeners are for this pledge drive. So that makes us proud of our listeners, and I think we're really helping out the pledge drive for St. Jude.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it is really kind of you to listen to us make this pledge. I know this is taking a long time, but honestly, sorry, not sorry, because it's worth it. So thank you so much. We really appreciate you. And again, I will reiterate, just because we donated $7,000 and change, some of us almost $8,000, even though we did that, you can donate $7. That's fine. We're still happy about that. Don't let us lead you any other way. We're still very happy about that. So please.
Like the majority of the money is not the people donating thousands of dollars. It's small donations. Give $10, give $20, give $5, anything you can.
Yep. So please, stjude.org, stjude.org/ATP. Thank you. Let's do some follow-up. A Mac Mini redesign updates from Mark Gurman. So, Mark had announced some expected Mac Mini redesign changes and whatnot, and then has gone back to the well and has clarified a bit. So Mark writes, the M4 Pro version of the Mac Mini will have 5 USB-C ports, 3 on the back, 2 on the front, like the Mac Studio. That model will also retain an Ethernet port, good, HDMI port, good, and headphone jack, sure. But prepare to say goodbye to the USB-A ports found on the current Mac Mini.
I mean, that's also fine. Like, I'm happy with this. Like,
yep.
To me, like, the retention of most of the things on it, I'm happy with that. And USB-A, like, it's been very helpful to have USB-A ports on lots of things long into the USB-C transition. I do think it's now time that we can drop them on most things.
I agree wholeheartedly. Now we're going to get everyone writing to us about how wrong we are, but here, you can't win them all. Then Mark continues, I've also been told that the computer's power supply will be internal. This was a big deal because they're saying, the new Mac Mini is going to be roughly Apple TV sized. And although the Apple TV does indeed have its power supply internal, which is to say you just plug in a cord, there's no brick involved. But, that's kind of a computer, but not really a whole computer. And so people were justifiably a little worried that perhaps this wouldn't be the case with the Mac Mini. Maybe it would go more like the current iMacs, which have the brick on the outside. But nope, apparently the power supply will be internal, which I am very happy about.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is, do you know if the Logitech, like the little RF dongle things for their wireless mice, because Bluetooth stucks, if they're USB-C now?
As far as I know,
Mike was
not.
Mike was just complaining about this on Upgrade This Week, and as far as I know, they're not. Now, I do take a little bit of offense at you saying Bluetooth sucks. Maybe I'm a Bluetooth unicorn, but I really don't see the issue with using Bluetooth peripherals.
It's so much worse than the little RF dongles in pretty much all possible ways.
Except you don't have to have a dongle, which is great.
I mean, honestly, that is very, like, I've in various, gaming laptops and stuff, I do use other mice besides Apple's Magic Mouse. And other people in my family use. We have mice all over the house. I have so far not found a compelling case for the custom RF dongles. To me, there's a compelling case for wired mice, especially in a gaming PC situation or just a PC situation in general. There's a compelling case for wired mice, and there's a compelling case for Bluetooth mice. And the other options I just have not found to be worth their hassles. Like, I know they're lower latency and different. Like, I know there are technical
advantages. It's not even that. That's all true. Like, the advantages for it, and they actually have, like, gaming mice that are wireless now with some super wireless protocol, whatever. It's mostly the fact that, Bluetooth range and reliability is often at the limit for desktop computers, even for laptops, if you keep it far away, of working well. Like, I mean, my computer is my tower computer. I can touch it with my hand. It's not that far away. But no Bluetooth mouse can reliably communicate with this computer. It's not that far away. RF dongle, I could be in the other room, smooth as glass, right? And that's the advantage. It's just so much better range and reliability at the cost of filling one of your ports with a little thing. And the reason I ask about the little dongles is because, yeah, this is the Mac Mini. You know, if you're going to get rid of a big port, get rid of it on the computer that has Mini in the name. It's supposed to be small. They're making it smaller. I get it. It's fine. Drop it. But the alternative is to have, you know, a dongle, like a little the stupid white dongle or, you know, some other thing hanging off the back of it that you then attach your little RF dingus to if you have a mouse like that. And that's more cumbersome than having a bigger computer with no dongle in some situations. So there is a balance here. Obviously, we should just be blaming Logitech and say, why are you still shipping USB-A dongles?
You're not wrong.
Make a USB-C one. Like, it's obvious. The actual thing that's in there is so tiny, I'm sure it could fit. But anyway. That's the only downside I can see. Is like, why would you still have USB-A ports? You've got, like, those YubiKey things and, like, DRM stuff for expensive applications and RF adapters for mice.
Indeed. All right. So with regard to minimum amounts of Mac RAM, which we were talking about in the context of going to, what is it, 12 gigabytes of RAM in future Mac
Pro? 16.
Mac, 16. I'm sorry. Thank you. Brian writes, I was at Apple's 1996 Worldwide Developer Conference where Gil Emilio, I got that right this time. See, it's GIF, not GIF. Anyway, made the announcement during the keynote that all future Mac models would ship with a minimum of 12 megabytes of RAM, up from 8. As I remember, that announcement got a standing ovation from the developers in attendance. And then apparently after ruminating, and this is years later, I think, after ruminating about my recollections of the WWDC keynote, I'm no longer confident in my description of the response as a standing ovation. This was, I think, Brian had written us a little while later. Anyways, instead, the enthusiasm of the applause was more along the lines of we were expecting the next RAM jump would be to 16 megs, not 12, but hey, we'll take it.
12 megabytes of RAM, kids.
We did a lot with a little back then.
Ugh.
All right. Cigar Jaw writes with regard to the screen recording badge on outgoing video. Excluding the screen recording badge from outgoing video is actually possible, but it requires the full access screen capture API rather than the window selection one. The way it works is that the screen recording badge is an extra child window added by the system that you can mask out while streaming. I didn't know that. The additional API is required since the window picker lets the system handle the selection, then it hands you the frames, and this includes the recording badge by default. Removing it requires assembling the window list yourself, which is quote-unquote more sensitive.
So as usual, to provide a better experience to your users, you need to use the API that Apple doesn't want you to use.
Indeed. With regard to JPEG XL, Kelly Tom, this is, you know, the alleged new codec that Apple's going to be embracing. Well, it's not that new, but Apple's going to be embracing it, which is new. Kelly Thompson writes, support for reading JPEG XL images has been available on the Apple platform since last year. They work in Safari preview photos and all the apps like Pages and Keynote. Here's the kicker, though. You have all that beautiful dynamic range, but Preview and Safari don't support HDR images of any type quite yet. Safari supports HDR video, but not stills. Obviously, HDR images work great in photos. It's a weird state of half in, half out. JPEG XL has been jointly developed by Cloudinary, which I'd never heard of, and Google. For ages, JPEG XL support was behind a flag in Chrome. Everyone was just waiting for them to turn it on. Then they released a chart saying AVIF handily beats JXL and removes support. And we'll put a link to the chart in the show notes. The entire web responded saying, in fact, the chart showed the exact opposite. And everything above quality 55, which is where the vast majority of images saved are, JPEG XL handily beat AVIF at every point. In fact, JPEG XL isn't optimized at those low quality levels because it's not really usable. The Google team that works on JPEG XL is in Europe, and the team that works on Chrome is in California. Well, either way, from the Chromium bug tracker, request reopen JPEG XL issue. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. You may already be receiving images, in this format without even realizing it. Major cloud delivery services already offer JPEG XL as an option to browsers that support it. One cool feature of the default JPEG XL encoder, CJXL, is that you can get to select an effort level from 1 to 10. If time isn't a critical factor, the encoder can spend more time optimizing file size. If not, you can compress them as fast as JPEG at the expense of some size. Here's a beta version of a tool we developed for the upcoming JPEG XL website that shows the relationship between distance, effort, quality, and encoding speed. And so we'll put a link in the show notes. I can tell you that did not work on the Safari that I have in Sonoma, Sonoma that we're on, right? That's the current one. It's Sequoia that's new, right? Yes. I haven't tried it in Chrome or anything. John, if you're talking, you're muted. Hi, future Marco.
Hi.
Sorry, I was muted. It works for me in Safari. It doesn't work for you?
Let me try it again.
I mean, it doesn't work in Chrome, obviously, because that's the point of this feedback, that Chrome had support for JPEG XL and then removed it because they're championing AVIF and everyone is mad about it. But yeah, it works for me in
let
Safari.
Me try. Well, I'm assuming it doesn't work because it does work now. Maybe, I don't know what happened before. My mistake. I apologize. That was fake news on my part. My mistake.
Right. Anyway, it's kind of like if you have like Image Optim and those other sort of PNG Crush and all those utilities that say like use more computation time to make the image a little bit smaller. That's like built into this format, so you have an adjustable how much effort you want to put in to getting the smallest size possible. Which is just, it's really just a honeypot for web developers, because every web developer will say, I will spend 24 hours making this image smaller because it's going to be served a hojillion times in the 30 seconds after I post it. You know what I mean? So every little bit that we can crush this image makes it. And that was the same thing with CDNs vending JPEG XL versions based on the browsers that they know support them or whatever. So yeah, JPEG XL could be out there and you could be receiving it. But yeah, the support in macOS, I'm hoping if Apple does announce, hey, these new iPhones have this new image format, if that even happens at all, I hope support comes to the rest of their platforms. Like things like Preview and even Safari not being able to show HDR still images in any format, let alone JPEG XL, seems like a limitation that they should overcome, and this would be the perfect time to do it. So, again, I'm rooting for this rumor. This is still just a rumor that Apple's doing this, but regardless of the rumor, Apple has been adding JPEG XL support slowly and steadily to their platforms. It's just not fully baked yet, and they certainly haven't announced that they're switching the iPhone camera to use it, as the rumor says they will.
All right. So moving along, we need to talk about the FTC's non-compete agreements ban, which if you recall, the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, said here in America, hey, you can't have non-competes anymore. That's not fair. To which a federal judge said, hold my beer. Reading from The Verge, a federal judge has blocked the Federal Trade Commission's ban on non-compete agreements that make it difficult for workers to join their employers' rivals or launch competing businesses. The ruling prevents the FTC's ban on non-compete agreements from taking effect on September 4th, which is today, though the agency could still appeal the decision. On August 20th, U.S. District Judge Ada Brown in Dallas, Texas, ruled that the antitrust agency exceeded its statutory authority to ban practices related to unfair methods of competition, saying the non-compete agreements ban is, quote, unreasonably overbroad without a reasonable explanation, quote, and would, quote, cause irreparable harm, quote. To whom, Judge Brown? To whom? Brown's decision now stops the FTC from blocking non-competes nationwide after initially delaying the ban with a preliminary injunction in July. The ruling upholds a lawsuit that tax firm Ryan LLC filed in April to challenge the non-compete agreements ban, arguing that it would make it difficult for companies to retain talent. Here's an idea. Work harder to retain the freaking talent.
It would make us harder to retain talent if we couldn't legally handcuff our employees by telling them they can't get a job in the same industry for some arbitrary amount of time.
Get out of here with that nonsense.
I love, it's just this, the things that are quoting here, like it's unreasonably overbroad without a reasonable explanation. I'm pretty sure the people on the other side of this case gave a reasonable explanation for why non-competes are bad. Now, maybe they mean a reasonable explanation of why this particular agency has the ability to do this or whatever. It's frustrating. We would hope that collectively we can find a way that will survive judicial challenge to get rid of this horrible thing that is non-competes. The state of California did it somehow. The U.S. government still working on that. So fingers crossed.
It's so gross. I dislike it so very much. Moving along, though, apparently more governments would also like in on pooping on the App Store because Spain has launched an investigation into Apple's App Store. This was in July. Reading from MacRumors, the National Commission of Markets and Competition, the CNMC, this week announced a probe into the App Store, citing concerns that the company might be imposing unfair trading conditions on developers who distribute their applications to the platform. The investigation was initiated ex officio, reflecting the significant economic influence of app stores in Spain. Apple's practices could constitute an abuse of a dominant position, which is prohibited under Spanish competition laws and the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, TFEU. Additionally, India has an antitrust probe which finds Apple has abused its position in the apps market. Reading from Reuters, an investigation by India's antitrust body has found that Apple exploited its dominant position in the market for app stores on its iOS operating system, engaging in, quote, abusive conduct and practices, quote, a confidential report seen by Reuters showed. The Competition Commission of India, or CCI, has been investigating Apple since 2021 for possibly abusing its dominant position in the apps market by forcing developers to use its proprietary in-app purchase system. And then going for the trifecta, the UK has entered the chat. Reading from 9to5 Mac, a UK antitrust investigation into Apple is officially closed, despite finding the company to be at fault after the regulator missed a legal deadline. Whoopsie-dipsies. However, a case seems almost certain to be reopened under an upcoming law, which will grant new powers to the Competition and Markets Authority, or CMA.
I wonder if all these governments are, like, cheating off each other, or, like, the language in these stories from three entirely different outlets is so similar, and the language of all of their complaints is so similar that it's like, these places smell blood in the water, and they're like, well, this is a thing now. Everyone's, you know, trying to tamp down the App Store, citing the same type of things, lack of competition, abusing dominant position, yada, yada. So everyone's getting in on the act. Now, how will these all turn out? Who knows? But the problems for Apple are just getting started. As we said they would when this started, like, years and years ago, we're like, when one country does this, more are going to follow. It's not going to be like, oh, you're going to satisfy the Japan Trade Commission, and that'll be it. You'll never hear about this again. Nope.
All right. So it is time for everyone's favorite tradition, which was a genuinely excellent idea that Marco came up with a few years back. This is the iPhone 15 exit interview. Marco, would you like to introduce this?
Yeah. Started doing this a few years ago. As Casey said, this is basically, you know, on the eve of the iPhone's replacement, the episode before they're going to have their event and launch the new one, I like to send the old one out kind of with an exit interview of, like, how was the outgoing phone this year? You know, now that we've had a whole year of usage, and it kind of helps inform, you know, other shows, you know, more often do kind of direct, like, you know, predictions or wish lists of what we want for the next phone that'll be announced, you know, presumably next week. And I think having it kind of framed as an exit interview of the previous phone helps to inform kind of what matters and, you know, what kind of progress we're actually hoping to have and in what areas. So we're going to start with the iPhone 15 Pro. And now, to be clear, John, you didn't have the 15 Pro, right? This wasn't your year?
Yeah, but my wife did. So right. I've experienced the phone.
Right. And Casey, you had the big one for the first time, and I have the medium-sized one. Which I guess is the small technically, but it's, you know, there's only two sizes.
That's right.
And
but Aaron did get a 15 Pro, not a Pro Max. So I've used it some, obviously not as much as she, in the same way that John has used Tina's some. But you are the only one of the three of us that has actually used it full time.
Great. So iPhone 15 Pro, I would say the number one thing that I absolutely love about this phone, USB-C. We were waiting for it for so long. Mm-hmm. They finally gave it to us in the 15 line, and this is not a small deal. This has been a big deal. This has been so nice. So not only do I have, you know, easier charging everywhere that I am, like, because all over my house, my backpack, my, you know, traveling, now we just have one kind of cable, and it charges everything. It's amazing. There are no more lightning cables in my travel bag at all. And around the house, there are hardly any lightning cables necessary for almost anything. The only thing we use lightning for is charging Apple TV remotes, which we almost never have to do. Like, that's literally, like, you know, maybe twice a year we have to charge an Apple TV
remote. Well, the modern ones are USB-C.
Yes,
I just
never upgraded to that one. But mm-hmm. I'm sure I will soon, actually. But anyway, so no more lightning cables for almost anything except for, yeah, Apple TV charging for the remote. Also, on my desk, I have to have one to power up older iPhones that I use as test phones, and also to charge Magic Mice and Magic Trackpads. That's it. Like, oh, and I guess a couple of my older AirPods cases. But even, like, my travel AirPods Pros are now the USB-C model there, which is an upgrade I strongly recommend. It's so good.
Oh, I really want to do it, but I'm too cheap.
It feels so wasteful, but, like, I had to get a second pair because one of the old ones finally died, and so I got the new one. Oh, man. It's so nice. But anyway, yeah. Having all USB-C, total game changer. I've even found that there's a lot of kind of like little things you can now do that you couldn't do as easily or at all before because it supports USB-C. So for instance, I can plug in my big Fuji camera with a regular USB-C cable, even just a, quote, charging cable that only uses, like, slow USB 2 speeds, I can connect that directly from the camera to my phone and import photos. It's glorious.
That's
like,
nice.
So much little stuff like that just works. Some audio equipment works that way, too. Like, I've found it is just USB-C has been an awesome upgrade on the iPhone. And if you are still holding on to an older phone and you're wondering, like, should I upgrade, you know, this year or whatever, USB-C alone is a great reason to upgrade. But, you know, that's obviously how much that's worth to you depends on the pricing. But wow, is it nice. That is so much nicer. Like, I knew it would be nice to just, like, you know, get rid of some cables. I had no idea how nice it would be. So I am extremely, even like, you know, simple stuff. Like, you know, you have like a USB, you know, battery pack that you're using to charge up something. And you want, oh, can I top up my phone for a minute? Yeah, sure. Just pop out whatever you're charging and plug it into the phone. And then you unplug the phone and plug in a laptop or an AirPods case or whatever. All with the same cable, all connected to the same battery without having to like mess with things. Oh, it's so nice. It is so good. So yeah, USB-C, A+.
Yeah, just to jump in really quickly. I, like Marco said, I knew this was going to be an improvement for sure. I didn't realize how vast an improvement it was going to be. It is so empowering is a bit dramatic, I think, but I can't think of a better word for it at the moment. It's so empowering to look at any of my devices, asterisk, and any cable I have nearby and say, yep, that'll work. And maybe it won't be as quick as I want, be that data or power. But one way or another, anything can charge anything. Just the other day, on one of the final pool days we had before our little community pool had closed, a friend of ours came and she has an iPhone 15 Pro, I guess, as well. Yeah, because it's USB-C. Anyways, she has an iPhone 15 Pro and it was near death because she had forgotten to charge it the night before. And I didn't have a charger with me, but I had my fully charged iPad with me and I had a USB-C cable in the car and I said, hold on, I know what I'll do. And I went and I grabbed my USB-C to C cable from the car, plugged iPhone into her iPhone. And sure enough, her phone slurped up some of the charge from my iPad, which was totally fine. Having anything being able to charge anything, again, asterisk, et cetera, is so great. And to your point, Marco, not having to carry 44 different cables is so nice. It's so wonderful to not have to care if the thing I need to be charged is the computer, is the iPad, is the phone. It doesn't matter. All of them charge the same way.
Yeah. And the only downside I would say is that the USB-C hole on the phone does get like lint from your pocket in there in a way that is harder to remove than with Lightning. With Lightning, you could put pretty much anything up there and just kind of scrape it out and it would just kind of fall out. USB-C, I did have an issue earlier in the year where I had to like where I thought my port was breaking because I just couldn't get cables to sit right or charge reliably, and it was just crap in the port. And I had thought it wasn't because I had just done like some basic, you know, clean out with like one of those plastic tools, thinking like maybe this will do it. And it took like a little bit deeper of a clean to get all that stuff out, and it was just stuff in the port. It was just, you know, harder to get out than Lightning. But other than that, it's been only benefit. And I also, like, I thought, and we've been talking for, you know, years before they did this, I really thought that the public perception of the USB-C change would be as harsh as it was when they switched from the dock connector to Lightning.
Yeah, that's true. Sense, like, I thought the exact same.
Like regular people out there hated the switch to Lightning from the dock connector because they were like, Apple is just doing this as a cash grab to, you know, to sell new cables and new bricks, whatever. And you know, this time I thought we would have the same problem, and we just didn't. And I think that's largely because USB-C is not proprietary to Apple. And so when they made this change, there was already a massive marketplace of USB-C cables and chargers made by everybody. And so it was not as much of like, oh, they're trying to sell their own cable. Like, I'd be surprised if Apple sells many of their own cables. I think most people just get whatever they can on Amazon and it's fine.
I'm pretty sure if you go back and listen to old episodes of ATP, all those reasons you just cited were actually cited back when we were discussing this. So I don't think either one of you or any of us actually thought it would be as bad, and then because we listed those reasons, and lo and behold, it wasn't. Although that said, I think it has been even quieter than we thought it would be, because when we were discussing it, we're like, okay, well, is this going to be as bad? Here are these mitigating factors that could make it not as bad. But not only was it not as bad as Lightning to USB or Lightning to 30-pin to Lightning, I think it was just pretty much a non-issue. I mean, maybe it's more of an issue outside our circles. Maybe most people don't have a USB-C phone. Maybe it's lagging. But right now, on the eve of the iPhone 16, I think it is exceeded expectations into how much better the transition was, even though I think we all said it was going to be better. We didn't think it was going to be this much better.
And I certainly did not think it was going to be, as you said, like this quiet. Like no one – see, it's – I heard no complaints from literally anybody that they changed the port. Like, you know,
yeah,
and granted,
I mean, you're either
right that, like, you know, they not everybody is on that fast of an upgrade cycle. But still, I literally heard zero problems about this.
Oh, speaking of the port, on the flip side, my wife's iPhone 15 Pro is the only USB-C phone in the house. And so we have the opposite problem here, where it's not like we've gone to this whole USB-C lifestyle. We have this, like, communal chargers everywhere with lightning stuff, and we had to add the right number of USB-C things there. Now, arguably, we should have been adding them before because we've got USB-C iPads, but we just happen to have other places to charge our iPads. But now, every place where there's a bunch of lightning cables, there's now at least one USB-C cable in the mix. Eventually, we'll fully transition, but it's going to be a while because my wife uses, I believe, four, maybe three. She carries four iPhones. She uses three of them for Pokemon Go. One of them is her work phone.
That's right.
So it's just like a brick. Can you imagine how much like four Pro phones weigh? It's just so heavy. Anyway, it's going to be a while before all four of those phones are on USB-C. So I have a long road ahead of me with a combination of Lightning and USB-C on all our communal chargers.
And, you know, and while we're on USB-C here, I just wanted to give a shout out to USB-C power delivery as a spec and as a product ecosystem. USB-C PD has, and for the less nerdy people out there, that is the spec that allows USB-C to deliver much higher power amounts than old USB could ever deliver. That's how you can get USB to power an entire laptop by itself, for instance. The move in general for so many tech products, and even products that are kind of just barely tech products, the move to being powered by USB-C and USB-C PD wattages has made overall life so much just like a little bit nicer in a lot of ways. It's like the inverse of paper cuts. Like, you know, we complain about little paper cuts on little annoyances and products. This is like, you know, whatever the opposite of a paper cut would be, a paper circle. I don't know. I can't think of a good word that's funny. But it is just little delights. I guess that's the word. All the time. little delights where there are like there, and you don't necessarily realize it. Once you've moved to the USB-C world, you don't realize how good you have it until you have to go use something older that has its own power brick or its own like older USB micro or whatever port. And the world we have now is so nice because all of that stuff about like, wow, I can charge all my like my phone and my iPad and my laptop from all the same thing. That's true. And that shows in lots of bigger ways now too. Like so many other gadgets or things are now powered by USB because it's just kind of cheaper and widely available and like so many devices. I even have like a power drill that is powered by USB-C now.
Oh my word.
Its own built-in, like, which is, and I mean, look, I'm not a contractor, but for my purposes, it's totally fine. Like there are so many things like that now that are entering my life gradually over the last few years that just, oh, this new XYZ thing, this is now USB-C powered. Like, you know, it could be so many things, like toothbrushes, vacuum cleaners, like so many things are now being USB-C powered. And the more stuff that you get like that in your life, the more those little conveniences and delights you run into sometimes. I need to get a new power adapter for my, you know, drill. Do I have to buy the proprietary thing from the drill company? No, it's just USB-C. I want to have a shorter or longer cable for this gadget. Do I have to buy a special thing or see if anybody makes a weird one on Amazon? No, you can just use USB-C. Like there are so many little tiny things like that that add up in your life over time the more you're into the USB-C lifestyle. So thank God for the Europeans for forcing this upon Apple. And thank God for the ecosystem for being here and for pretty gradually, but now with quite some speed behind it, converting over to this wonderful lifestyle. It is wonderful. I love USB-C. Even for the data side of it, yeah, it's a mess. The power side of it is awesome.
Yeah, agreed.
Let me give the EU partial credit because, as I think we said before, I think Apple would have switched with or without the EU. It's just a question of the individual timing. They may not have even done it at exactly the same time because they did do it earlier than required. But Apple's lack of investment in Lightning and the lack of expansion in the capabilities of that port made it inevitable that they would eventually go to USB-C. So they have.
And I think, you know, one of their stated goals, one of the EU stated goals, was reducing e-waste. And I think largely this does that. Like, the move of so many things to USB-C power, I think really does reduce e-waste. Because, like, think of, again, like, go through your tech closets and see how many things there are that have their own custom power bricks and stuff that now the modern versions of those don't, because they can be USB-C powered. I think they make a pretty big impact here. So I, again, so happy about this change. All right, let's move on to the other headlining feature of the iPhone 15 Pro, the action button. It's funny, like, it got out there. There was a little bit of drama here and there with cases, and then we pretty much never heard about it for the rest of the year. But I got to say, I find the action button so useful that I instantly took it for granted. Like, the idea now of using a phone without the action button would be a significant paper cut to me. It would be like a significant step down, because I use mine. I have it set up for the flashlight. I know there's lots of other ideas people have for it, but I need a flashlight fairly frequently. And I use it at least twice a day. And I just, love having that hardware button there. It is fantastic.
Yeah, I use mine for camera. And I know that many would call that a kind of a novice or noob approach, because there are many other ways to get to your camera, most of which are fairly quick. But I don't want to have to think about it or have to worry about swiping in just the right way that it actually listens to me and swipes the way I want it to go from the lock screen. And so for me, I love having the camera as my action button action. And I use that at least daily. I don't personally think I would use the flashlight quite as much, but hey, that doesn't mean you're wrong at all. If it works for you, that's all that matters. I don't know that I would be lost or anything without having the action button, you know, in a future phone if for some reason it went away, but I definitely would miss having it for sure. And maybe one day I'll use it for something more advanced. But yeah, I think the action button also gets a thumbs up from me for sure.
I think the camera is a perfectly good thing to use it for. My success rate at doing the swipe gesture for the camera is so low.
Yeah,
I end up using the what you would think would be the even slower one, where you have to hold your finger on the little camera icon. It's like there's a delay. You're like, why are you using the one with the delay? That's got to be slower. No, because when I try to swipe and it fails, and I try to swipe and it fails, it's always when I'm like, oh, got to get the camera out quick, you know, because something cute is happening or whatever, right? That is the time when I am completely unable to get the camera up. So the action button is going to be great. But I have to say that when I need to get my camera out real fast, it's almost always my phone and not my wife's phone. So I actually haven't built the habit of using the action button, even though hers is set to camera, because I'm never grabbing her phone real quick to take a picture, because going over to where she is or getting her phone is going to kill the time that it would be required anyway. So I'm looking forward to my iPhone 16 with the action button so that I can build that habit, because I can almost guarantee that pressing that side button is going to have a much higher success rate than me trying to swipe or me having to hold my finger down on that little thing.
Yep, very much so.
And then finally, the only other thing I'll say about the iPhone 15 Pro is that the thermals really have been pretty bad. It really, you know, we all saw right at the beginning, we're like, this phone seems to run hot, really hot. It does. It does run very hot, and it does thermal throttle itself a lot in use, especially like in the sun in a car. That's why I had to like buy a chiller phone mount that uses, you know, a thermoelectric element just to cool the phone down in the car, just so I could keep the display on and take any power whatsoever. Like, this phone runs hot, and it has run hot since day one. And Apple tried to, I think they successfully mitigated the bad press that could have resulted from that when people started reporting that right at the beginning. And they issued they said it was a software issue, and they issued a software update. It wasn't a software issue. It was a hardware flaw. This phone overheats much more easily than previous phones did. And the rumors are that the upcoming 16 Pros that should be announced next week apparently have a modified and better thermal design. And that's so that is, when I look at my 16 Pro wish list, it's actually really short. I want better thermals, and I could use the 5X camera that Casey has, which it does seem like both of those things have been pretty solidly rumored the entire time for that.
I have to say, though, how many years? I think it's been like 3 or 4 years that there have been rumors of better cooling in iPhones. Vapor chambers, graphite sheets. Not just this year, not just for the iPhone 70, but last year, and the year before that, and the year before that, and we have never gotten them. So I really, really hope this is the year, because those rumors are always, and the reason they're there is every year, like, again, if you have a phone out in the sun, they will overheat, right? Or if when you first update your phone and it's doing all the indexing, they get hot. People don't like that. And so they're always like, boy, could there be better cooling? And then you look at what Apple has done with cooling, and we know they could do more, because Android phones are like, what more can we do? Can we do more than just having, you know, a heat sink up against a thing and so on and so forth? And yes, you can. Lots of other phone makers have done things. And so whenever we see the rumors, Apple's going to do it. They're going to put those graphite sheets in there. They're going to use more thermal paste. They're going to use a vapor chamber. Every year, we're just disappointed. And obviously, the 15 Pro had what the heck is the chip? The A... 18 Pro? I don't even remember the numbers anymore.
Yeah, the one on the new 3-nanometer process.
Right. And so it was a really... They were pushing the limits with that chip on that process that Apple's already moving away from. I kind of see why it had thermal issues. And I also kind of see why this would have been a good phone to try out those graphite sheets. You know what I mean? Like, but no, it didn't happen. So I really hope it does come on the 16. But if we go another year and everyone says, oh, those rumors were for the 17, not the 16, I am going to be disappointed. Despite the fact that in general, I haven't noticed my wife's phone getting particularly hot, except for when she's playing Pokemon Go, in which case that makes all of her phones hot. But, you know, as long as it gets the job done, as long as it doesn't, you know, stop working, which is your problem when you have it in the car, like it literally stops being able to be used for the thing you're trying to use it for because the screen gets so dim you can't see it anymore. I don't know if the 15 Pro was over any kind of limit to bother people more than some past phones, but it's time for Apple to invest a little bit more in cooling on their top-end phones.
You know, it's funny you bring all this up, because I do agree that throttling is an issue and that the thermals are not stellar, but I would actually say, to my estimation, this was a mild improvement over past years. And, you know, when I'm using my phone at the aforementioned pool, I think it was the 14 Pro, maybe it was the 13 Pro, but I want to say it was the 14 Pro. That bad boy was so dark, I could barely read it pretty much always. Whereas this one, it definitely gets dim and noticeably so. But I feel like not only would it recover quicker, but it didn't get as dim as either the 13 or the 14. So while I don't disagree that we do, I think we do need improvements, and I hope for improvements, I actually thought that this was a slight improvement over years past, although not a great one.
I think you're just experiencing screen improvements there, and not necessarily thermal improvements, right?
Very well could be.
I think just the screen is brighter and takes less power at a given level of brightness, so now the dim one is not as dim, and you're attributing that to better cooling or better thermals, but I think it's just screen improvements that you're benefiting from there. But anyway,
it doesn't feel like that's the case, but you very well could be right.
Well, and there's
either way, the experience isn't as bad as it has been. That's the thing, right, though. It's very situational. Like if you buy a car with a big glass roof and all of a sudden your phone is overheating because on the dashboard is getting more direct sunlight, you're going to say, oh, it's the phone's fault, but maybe it's because you got a new car, right? Like all of these phones have always been very vulnerable to being in direct sunlight for any amount of time. And it's just a question of, do you start putting your phone in more direct sunlight? And if so, you will perceive that phone as being worse thermally. But I mean, this 15 Pros, I have heard people saying, gets a little bit warmer than they expected. And like a lot of these things, especially with the SoC, the heat is very localized, and it's when the SoC is doing a lot of work, right? There's the thing that gets hot is that little SoC in there. And so on iPhone setup day, when it's redoing all your indexes and doing all that stuff, yeah, it's going to get real hot and people are going to notice. But I think over time with normal phone usage, where you just pick it up, scroll through something and put it back down, it doesn't really get a chance to get that hot until you put it on the dashboard of your car.
Yeah. And then I guess one more thing on the 15 before we leave it. I really do appreciate the titanium as a weight-saving measure. I don't think it needs to necessarily be titanium specifically. It could be lots of other... It could be aluminum, for all I care. Like, aluminum was fine for a long time, and it is lighter than titanium, even. So that would be fine as well. But I'm very glad they switched away from steel. I do know that, like, apparently they switched to titanium, and some of the structural changes they made inside, I think, were actually part of the problem with the thermals, and I believe that that's part of why they had to revise them for the 16 line next week. But overall, it does feel very good in the hand. It feels great. So I love the overall design of it, with the exception that I think the colors were garbage for the Pro phone. Like, I got the natural gray one, which I thought... I don't know, last fall I was kind of in a gray mood, and I thought, this is going to be cool and different. And no, it's just gray. So
I slightly disagree with you there. It is just gray, but I do think it's a cool gray, like a neat gray. But I do mostly agree with you. If you'll permit me to just carry on, since I've already interrupted you. With regard to the 15 Pro Max, I don't hate the size. I don't hate the size. And I do like having a little more real estate. It turns out that if you have a phone this big and your hands aren't freakishly large, a pop socket is pretty much compulsory. I've been thinking long and hard about what I will do if the Tetra Prism 5X lens comes to the Pro but not Pro Max phone. So if the iPhone 16 Pro gets the 5X lens, sitting here now, I think I'm going to go back to the smaller one, with the human-sized one.
That'll be the test, actually, because right now you're like, oh, the big phone, it's annoying, but it's nice to have more screen real estate. You're really going to find out how much you care about that screen when you go back to a smaller one.
Yeah,
that's when you're going to notice. If you don't notice, it takes you a day or like fine or whatever, but if you look at that screen and you're like, I'm so used to seeing so much more stuff, or in this app I could see a whole other column of whatevers, that's going to really hurt you. So we'll see if you've irrevocably come one of the giant phone people, or whether you were just a tourist in their life.
Right. And sitting here now, I think I was just a tourist, but I say that with little to no conviction. And the thing that frustrates me so about the big phone is that for my hands, for my body, it's really not a one-handed phone for anything more than swiping vertically. And even still, if I'm using one hand, I must have the pop socket out. And I actually have come around on the pop socket. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. But I think in a perfect world, I would rather go back down to the standard size phone, presumably stop using a pop socket. I mean, we'll see what happens. And being able to use my phone one-handed, because it really is uncomfortable to use these giant phones one-handed. And I just really dislike that. I miss being able to use my phone one-handed. And I think what would happen is I would get the smaller phone, if this is the way I go. I'll get the regular size phone, and I'll say, man, I do miss that screen, but oh boy, is it nice to be able to use my phone one-handed again. And so I think ultimately that's going to win the day, but we'll see what happens. Now that I've shown that I can, or shown myself, that is, that I can handle a big phone, if there is some sort of big phone only feature that I feel interested in, like compelled by, then I'll just stick with the big phone. Now, the current rumors are that I don't think that's going to be the case, but if it is, I don't think I would like begrudge, for lack of a better word, you know, getting another big phone. But sitting here today, I don't think that's what I want to do. That being said, the 5X lens, I am very glad that I went for it and that I got it. There are definitely times that I want to be between 2 and 5 for sure. And I think, Marco, you were not whining about this. That's not the word I'm looking for either. But you were concerned about this before it came out. And I think it's a valid concern. There are definitely times that I want an in-between. And in a perfect world, I would want, you know, 1 or 1/2, 1, 2, 3, and 5. And I know that's nuts and that's not going to happen, but that would be excellent. But I stand by getting the big phone for the 5X lens. I really do feel like it gives me reach in scenarios that I wouldn't have gotten nearly as good a shot otherwise. And I don't want to give that up. So if for some reason the regular size phone doesn't get the Tetra Prism lens, I will almost certainly stick with the big phone. Having never had a big phone before, a lot of people would say that, oh, the battery life is infinite, not unlike the Apple Watch Ultra. You know, the battery life is forever. It's amazing. No. Or at least not in my experience. I don't feel like it's demonstrably better than the regular size phones. Maybe I'm using my phone now more now. Maybe I'm a banana. I mean, you know, maybe I'm off my rocker. I don't know. But I don't feel like the battery life was night and day better. I really don't. But I do think, to echo what Marco said, the USB-C, 4 thumbs up from me. The titanium, 2 thumbs up. I do think that the natural titanium is a good color, but I concur that the rest of the colors stank and it looks like they're only going to get worse. But yeah, I mean, all in all, I really do like these phones a lot. I really have enjoyed it. The one thing I will say, and I will say again, and I've said this for the last several years, the front screen is too easily scratched. I scratched the snot out of this thing. I have no idea how. It's so badly scratched that I am genuinely thinking I might become one of those lunatics that puts a screen protector on their phone, because this thing is scratched to hell. And I hate that. I hate it. And normally I would just go to Apple and use my Apple Care, you know, repair incident. And I'll probably try to do it to see if they'll do it. But last time I tried this, they were like, oh, it's not damaged enough, tough nuts. And I'm just barely honest enough that I don't just throw the thing on the ground in front of them and say, how about now?
It is definitely a weird incentive they've created there.
Right? I'm saying. I didn't do that last year. I don't plan on doing it this year. But but it is very tempting.
Sounds like somebody might need a phone pouch.
No, I
how are
you
scratching your screen? How is this happening?
How are you still using a phone pouch? What year is this?
I'm not, but Casey needs to be. I'm not using one. I have one scratch on my screen, and it is very small, and I've had this phone for 2 years, right? Yeah, I don't know what you're doing. Unless you're going to have someone follow you around with a camera to find out what you're doing as you stick your phone into your pocket full of sand, maybe you need a pouch.
I genuinely don't know. And these are not small scratches. Like, one of them is semi-horizontally.
Are you putting it in your pocket with keys?
No, I don't. It's got to be me. I'm not saying it's not my fault, but darned if I know what it was. And I've been rolling mostly caseless this year because I never really found a case I loved. I adored, what was it, the Peel case? I think we talked about this when it was new. I adored the Peel case, but they had a cutout for the action button, which I could not abide. And to the best of my knowledge, they never revised it. Like, what was the one that they sent out? Peak Design.
That's the one I've been using the last few months.
Yeah, and I have nothing against Peak Design case. It's just I really loved the Peel case so very much, but I could not abide the lack of anything for the action button. But I will say, in the defense of the glass, and actually David Schaub in the chat just reminded me of this. I have dropped this thing case free a handful of times, not dramatically, but a handful of times in cases where I was in situations where I was like, oh, here we go. Oh, well, at least I'll get a new screen now. But I've dropped it by accident a handful of times, and it's been no worse for wear, which I do appreciate. But golly, can I please have a less scratch prone screen? And I think
this trade off is the one Apple would say is the right one. It's probably better to people, because you've seen people use screens that are just destroyed.
Oh,
so
yeah.
People's tolerance for using screens that are messed up is great, but shattering is over a lot of people's limits. So the trade-off is essentially you can make it more scratch-proof, but then it's going to be more prone to shattering. And so the balance Apple has chosen is it's going to get a bunch of little hairline scratches all over it if you do whatever the hell Casey's doing, but it will be more resistant to full-blown shattering when you drop it. And despite the fact that might annoy some of us, who, like, if you're very careful with your phone, a harder screen that was more scratch-resistant would be better for you. But hell, I've dropped my phone plenty of times. It's dropped off my nightstand onto a wooden floor plenty of times. I've dropped it off the dining room table onto a wooden floor.
Yeah, like, but you're in a case, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in a case. But, you know, like, you could still get unlucky with the way it falls in that situation. So I've dropped it enough times that I'm glad that it is as shatter resistant as it is.
I mean, I am glad it's shatter resistant for sure. But and I do think you're right that this is a problem I can fix with a screen protector. And I think the more I think about it and the more I talk about it, the more I think I am probably going to not have to, but choose to do that for the next one. So if you have a screen protector recommendation that you swear by, please reach out via Mastodon. Don't email us because it's too much to email, please. But I would love to hear from on Mastodon or Threads for that matter, a screen protector that you enjoy.
And a clean room for Casey to apply it in.
Yeah, well, pretty much.
Some of them have gotten really advanced now. When you order most decent brand ones now, they come with basically little kits that lay it on in this like plastic cradle, and you like flip this thing right down exactly the right angle. Like, they get really pretty complicated to try to do it right.
Yeah, they're trying to help you as best they can because they know it's a difficult thing to do, but if you're doing in a house full of cat dander or something, you're kind of fighting uphill battle.
I mean, I've actually heard you're often better off having either sometimes the Apple Store will have people who are willing to do it for
you. Yeah, I've heard this too.
If you buy it there, but I don't even know if they still sell screen protectors there.
I think Best Buy does it too or something like that.
Yeah, and I heard too.
This is a skilled labor thing.
Yeah, like even like mall kiosks that sell phone accessories will often do it for you for some small fee. And usually, like, I would actually suggest maybe trying that option because, as John said, like, you know, when you buy one and try to apply it, you're doing this in your house with whatever conditions you can best approximate that are actually somewhat near maybe being ideal, but not quite ideal. And you're going to do, two of these a year at most? You know, so, like, you're not going to have the experience and the finesse of somebody who's doing it, like, 10 times a day.
On the other hand, you will care much more than they will. If you're the type of person who's getting a screen protector because you can't send even a single scratch on your screen, have fun in dealing with that single speck of dust that did get under there.
I mean, you're not wrong. But, well, this is a problem for Casey in a week or two. It's not a problem for Casey today. But, yeah, grand scheme of things, I really enjoyed this phone. And for no other reason, I think I would be all in because of USB-C, and everything else was just a bonus.
All right. Apple Watch Series 9.
Wait, before we move on from that.
Oh, all right.
You didn't even mention the iPhone, plain iPhone 15, and I want to say that I think this year is one of the rare cases where Apple seems to have gotten caught with their pants down a little bit by the AI thing. They shipped a line of phones, the 15 and the 15 Pro, seemingly without realizing that that 15 wouldn't be able to run next year's headlining feature. They're going to ship, well, maybe they won't ship it by then because they're not shipping Apple Intelligence, but they could have ended up shipping Apple Intelligence that wouldn't work on their latest non-Pro phone if they had actually shipped Apple Intelligence before the new phones came out. Like, I think it's unprecedented for a one-year-old phone not to be able to run the headlining feature of the next OS that came out after it a year later. And I just have to think it's because they didn't think that, oh, we can cheap out on the RAM on the 15. What's a big deal? The iPhone's got plenty of RAM. We're well within limits, blah, blah, blah. And here comes AI and LLMs using all your RAM. I will look back on this line, the 15 and 50 Pro, and always remember it as the year where the non-Pro phone had this crippling disability that was, you know, that could have been prevented with being a little bit more generous with RAM, but wasn't, and it put Apple in this strange, somewhat uncomfortable position of having to tell people who just bought a brand new phone last year that, yeah, you can't run Apple Intelligence.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I think it's largely, I mean, that largely just shows, like, the, hops, oh, he's dreaming. Hold on, I gotta poke him and wake him up. He hardly ever barks anymore because he's...
It sounded like a full-on bark.
Yeah, because he's mostly deaf. He hears a little bit still, but not much. And when dogs are mostly deaf, they become very relaxed. Because as far as they're concerned, like, I can't hear anything going on. Everything must be fine. Like, they, you know, normally, you know, he used to be our doorbell. You know, somebody would knock on the door, he'd start barking because that's what dogs do. Oh, my God, someone's here. Everyone alert, you know. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, like, when they can't hear much anymore, they're really chill because they're like, oh, I guess no one's here. Fine. You know?
Well, I ask in part because just like a week or so ago, Penny had some sort of, like, nightmare or something. She sleeps in the room with us but not in the bed with us. And she was doing, like, her dream bark just incessantly. But for her, it's like a one-third to at most half volume bark.
Yes,
instead of, like, a full-on
yeah.
woof, it's like more of a murf, murf, you know,
yeah,
or
it's
whatever.
Like trying to talk with your mouth closed.
yeah, that's fair. I just asked because it sounded as though he was doing a full-on bark, but it was hard to tell. Yeah.
If you have any hound in your dog, do what my dog does, which is the sleeping howl.
Oh, no.
Goodness. I have never heard Penny howl, not one time.
I don't think
yeah,
Hops
I think it's
howl.
A breed thing, but yeah.
Anyway, so Apple Touch. I think that speaks to just how far ahead iPhone components are planned, like, and how recently, relatively speaking, Apple realized they had to get in on the LLM game. Because, you know, the iPhone 15 non-Pro components were probably a lock, like, what, 2 years ago, maybe? Like, you know, we know they have pretty long timelines for a lot of that stuff. And so they probably started Apple Intelligence shortly after that was decided, or around the same time. You know, maybe they didn't know yet when they started doing LLM research and development. Maybe they didn't realize, like, we're definitely going to need X gigs of RAM to run this thing. You know, that was probably too early to know that. And a lot of Apple's efforts over the last year or two, like, they've actually open sourced some things and published papers about compressing LLMs to fit in smaller amounts of RAM. They've done a lot of work in that area. Why? We're seeing it now. Like, this is why they care so much about that.
Yeah, I think they are barely fitting it in the 8 gig phones. Like,
yeah,
all the, it's
so.
Been a lot of hard work to get it to fit in the 8 gig phones. And you can argue whether they were, you know, late to the game on LLM or because the lead time is so long they just couldn't help it. But this is another side effect of always being stingy with RAM. It's the unforeseen thing, right? It's like, we don't need this. Why would we ever give ourselves any kind of buffer? Let's cut it as close as we possibly can, save every penny, because why would we give any excess RAM if we think the low-end phone doesn't need that? We want to provide product differentiation. And the answer is, you never know when something might come along that makes your stinginess hurt you more than your stinginess is currently helping you. Now, Apple would probably argue, well, we're stingy 90% of the time and we only lose out on it 10% of the time, so it's still a win. But, you know, I still think that being that stingy with RAM, like, setting aside the AI thing, we've always said, when we talk about the Macs with selling them with too little RAM and having people upgrade or whatever, you want to give your users a better experience. And in general, more RAM gives a better experience. There are so many things more RAM does for you. Even on the 15 Pro, the fact that they had to work so hard to get Apple Intelligence into 8 gigs. That was their highest-end phone. Even on that one, they could have still provided differentiation and given the Pro 10 and the non-Pro 8 instead of 8 and 6. Anyway, they seem to have snapped out of that with the 16s, which are rumored to all have the same amount of RAM, and the 17s are rumored to all have even more RAM, so we'll see how this goes, but this is, you know, like I said, I'm gonna remember the 15, 15 Pro line with this one specific fact. Marco will remember it for USB-C, and I will remember it for the time that the non-Pro phone got left behind prematurely.
Well, and to be clear, it isn't only about being cheap when they limit the amount of RAM in phones. That is certainly part of it, and that's probably not a trivial part. But it's also about battery life. RAM takes power. Like, just having a certain amount of RAM, you have to be applying power to that part of the chip, even if it's not using that RAM for anything. Like, even if it's, you know, marked as free by the OS, you're still powering that chip to a certain base level. That's how DRAM works. So, and forgive me for experts in the field if I'm dramatically oversimplifying or if there's a whole bunch of asterisks on that now, there probably are. But in general, you don't want to put a whole bunch of RAM into something that's as battery constrained as a phone if you're not sure you're going to use it, because it does take battery.
No, but it's like, again, this is the Pro line, you know. You can give them a little bit more, which allows you to give the non-Pro line 8, which apparently is okay, you know, because the Pro's got 8, and their battery life is okay with an even hungrier SoC, right? So the plain 15 would also have been fine with 8. Like, you're right, it does take more RAM, but we're not asking for double. We're not asking double the RAM. It's like, just a little bit more. Just give yourself a little bit of headroom. Just don't be as stingy. You can still be stingy, but just not quite as stingy, because you never know when that's going to pay off.
All right. So, Apple Watch Series 9. I don't have a lot to say about the Series 9, except that I have found the double tap gesture, which was one of its new headlining features, to be fairly bad. I don't think it is fast enough or reliable enough to be useful. I have tried it over the last year many times. My hit rate with getting it to be recognized is low. And even when it is recognized, it takes a decent amount of extra time that you have to be still having the watch be, like, raised up and looking at it so the screen stays on. And then it shows this little animation to confirm that it understood your tap. And you could, like, it just feels very slow. And I have just mostly resorted to nose tapping the way I always have if I have to be one-handed to dismiss something, because it is just faster and literally more reliable. Like, it is more reliable for me to lift up the watch to my nose and tap it and hit the right spot on the screen than trying the double tap finger gesture. So I don't know if that's just me, but I have found generally the double tap is really not very useful.
Yeah, I mean, I have a Series 8, and so this is going to be a very expensive September for us because we're going watch and phone. We are on a 2-year plan on watches and a 1-year plan on phones. I feel like my complaints about the watch are the same as they ever were, which is to say the battery life is just straight up trash at this point.
Really? I don't find that. I mean, mine's a lot younger, obviously. It's like, you know, a year younger, but I find the battery life on the Series 9 is great, but I also didn't have any problems with the Series 8.
Well, that's the thing, is I think a year worth of Apple Watch battery is fine in my personal experience. 2 years, not so fine. And that's been a real bugbear for me, to the point that between Marco's friendly browbeating and also my friend in Richmond, Brad, just got a month or two ago, got an Apple Watch Ultra 2 or whatever the current one is.
Yep,
and
two. He
will not shut up about how good the battery life is on this thing. And at this point, I think I am probably going to hold out until whenever the next Ultra update is. And if that's next week, perfect. That'd be preferred. But if not, I will try to hold out as long as I can. And if I can't, I'll probably just commit to the existing one. But it's been so frustrating. And if I don't top off my watch at some point during the day, it will typically die sometime after dinner. And I'm just sick of it. I'm just over it. Now, also part of this is also influenced by the fact that I have the little watch. I have the 40mm, whatever the little one is.
Or 41, I think, for you.
Yeah, I forget what it is now, or what it was at Series 8. But I'm just sick of it. I'm sick of always having to worry about my watch's battery life. And so next time, it's going to be an Ultra.
So well, I'll come back to that in a second. The only thing I wanted to say about the Watch Series 9 specifically is that they removed the option for titanium with the Series 9. And I wish they didn't. And I hope for the Series 10 they bring back a titanium option for the non-Ultra watch. It was a bit like the titanium edition watch was not that much more money than a steel one. It was really nice. It was lighter. I think it looked more refined. It had like a nice brushed finish. Like it looked really nice. It felt really nice on the wrist. It was a way to have a little bit more subtle and a little bit lighter watch than the steel without going down in quality on things like the crystal that you have to do when you get the aluminum one. The aluminum one looks like aluminum. You know, it looks fine, but it doesn't look nice. The steel and the titanium both look very nice, and titanium, I think, was a little bit nicer of a look between the two, and again, I think it felt better. And also, Apple Watches tend to function better the lighter they are. The Taptic engine is more feelable, it moves on your wrist better, it sits on your wrist better, so I really hope they bring back titanium as an option on the Series 10, or whatever they're going to call it, Series X, Series 10, whatever.
Before you move on, and if you'd rather table this for later, we certainly can, but I would also be curious to hear what the status is of Adam's Apple Watch. And I don't remember what generation that is, but we've been kicking around the idea of getting Declan one for an upcoming birthday. And I'd be curious to hear what your, you know, year or two on review is of that.
The original one that we got him a few years back now was an SE, like the first gen watch SE. We replaced it a couple years back with, I think, a Series 5 or 6 that I had gotten Amazon refurbished or renewed or whatever they call it, for fairly cheap. He doesn't wear it currently anymore because the school banned them. kids will figure out like how to put notes in your Apple Watch to cheat on tests. So they banned them. So he hasn't worn it in a long time. It's been sitting in a drawer. It's probably fairly dead now. Anyway, so I don't. For now, he's just not using a watch, and I don't know when or if that will return, but we'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to you know, kind of what I'm hoping for the Series 10. So number one, titanium option. And just for the record here, I'm not talking about software at all right now. I think the Apple Watch, like you know, the watchOS 10 redesign changed a lot of things. I still am not super sold on some of the watchOS 10 changes and placements and buttons and gestures and things like that. I'm still getting everything wrong all the time. Like I'm still like pushing the wrong buttons or swiping the wrong edge to do things that I didn't want to do. Like, so, but that's just me. And of course, I always have opinions on watch faces. But going back to just the hardware, I really hope again titanium option on the non-Ultra series. Please bring that back. It was so nice. I'm also always hoping for. I guess this is kind of software. Sorry. I want display zoom on the Apple Watch. As you may know, my vision is slowly getting worse at close distances as I, you know, proceed through middle age. I use reading glasses for close-up reading of things sometimes. I'm not always wearing my reading glasses because I'm not always reading. So I have found as my vision has gotten slowly worse at that, at like, you know, short arm distance, very small complications and very small text in complications, like, say, the timer complication, which I use frequently, is getting a little hard to read. Now, iPhones have many different accessibility technologies for font sizing and element and UI sizing and different visual accommodations. The watch has almost none, which is surprising. There is dynamic type on the watch, which is you know the global text size setting, but it doesn't affect that many things on the watch. They also, on the phones, have this thing called display zoom, where that's the mode where when you set up your phone, I don't know if it still does this on all phones, but when you, during the that setup process, it'll ask you, like, do you want things to be this size or this size? And what it does is basically scale the entire screen up to simulate the field of view of, like, the next size smaller phone that existed or exists. So if you have like a Pro Max and you pick that option, it'll basically just blow up the screen dimensions of a Pro into the Pro Max screen. So you get everything scaled up perfectly, the same way you would do like a resolution change on a monitor on a computer. I want the watch to get that ability so that it can scale up everything, complications, the faces, everything, when you have a larger model watch to simulate the screen size of a smaller model watch blown up to its new size. I think that would be a great visual accommodation for people whose close-up vision is not that good or whose vision in general is not that good. Because, again, dynamic text on the watch is just not very well supported, doesn't go very far, and doesn't include almost anything on the watch face. So I would love to see that as an option. again, that is a software thing, but maybe it's, you know, requiring a certain GPU or whatever. And of course, the rumored larger screens that might be coming might make that easier to pull off and make it, you know, better of a feature. Before we get to the screens, I'll get there, but I'm hoping they found a way to keep the blood oxygen sensor. This is not a sensor I use frequently, but it's nice to have it, and we've had it. And I think, you know, whatever they need to work out with Masimo, you know, to license that tech, that patent, I think they should just do it.
Yeah. Finally, that is true. I am going to be really annoyed, just in principle, if the hardware, at least for the blood oxygen sensor, is not on whatever these new watches are. I'll be lightly annoyed if it remains disabled, which I expect it to. But I will be really annoyed if it's incapable. You know, if this patent dispute ever gets fixed, if it's incapable of doing any testing or measuring, that's going to really chat my butt.
Yeah. It's a minor feature. It's not going to be the end of the world if I lose it, but I just don't want to lose it. Like, over Apple being, you know, BSE about patent licensing. And I understand, look, we all hate patents, but, and they tried so hard, but, you know, you lost. Let's move on. The only other thing I'll get to for the hardware before we get to the screens is I really, really hope that the Apple Watch Series 10 supports Qi charging finally. Qi 2 as a standard, I believe, accommodates small enough devices that I believe the Apple Watch could be charged via Qi 2 if the watch wanted to support it. So I'm hoping, because again, like going back to our charging delights and paper cuts earlier with USB-C, I have now one cable and one port for everything except the Apple Watch. Yeah, you know, you can get like combo chargers that have like a special Apple Watch pad off to the side. But you know what's much more common? Batteries and chargers and stuff that just have a Qi pad and USB-C holes. So I would love to just have Qi support. Let me buy a battery from Anker or whatever on Amazon that has a USB-C output and a standard Qi pad, and I can put whatever I want there. An AirPods case, a second phone, or an Apple Watch while traveling. That would be really nice. And again, I think Qi 2 has added what is necessary to make that work. So I'm hoping for that. Now, about the screen sizes on the watch. There's been all these rumors that the watch regular series is growing, that there's going to be, you know, that basically the current small version, which I believe is 41 millimeter or 42, that is going to go away. And it's going to basically, like, that both of them are going to be going up in size by a decent amount. I think this is going to be a good move overall. You know, we've said over time that Apple has done a really good job satisfying the market for smaller watches way better than most other smartwatch makers have ever achieved it. But watch fashion and the smartwatch market have changed since the Apple Watch was introduced 10 years ago, substantially. And this happens. Like, in the watch world, the sizing of how big, like a standard, you know, and watches historically were very gendered. So there were like certain sizes of like, all right, this is, men's watches are going to be this size range for the most part, and women's watches are going to be this size range. And fortunately, in the era of smartwatches, first of all, a lot of the gendering has gone away to the point where now, like, you know, you don't, if you buy the small watch, people don't say that's the women's version. Like, it's just the small watch. And the big one, women can wear it, and no one's going to say you're wearing a man's watch. Like, thank God we've gotten rid of all that, you know, BS for the most part. But also, since the smartwatch era has really taken off over the last decade, also demand for large watches has gone up. And which is funny, because in the regular watch world, like the mechanical watch world, watches had gotten very big, you know, over the last, you know, 15 years. And then they kind of started going back a little bit. They're actually getting a little bit smaller now. But smartwatches are going the other way. Part of the reason so many people bought the Apple Watch Ultra is not because they were going to be climbing a mountain and then diving into 200 meters of water. Like, it's because they liked the bigger look. And that's for both functional reasons. Yes, it has, you know, better battery life, bigger screen. That's great for smartwatches. But also, big watches are just in fashion right now. Really huge smartwatches are in style. And most people that I see are not wearing the small one anymore. I see a lot of people of a lot of different sizes and ages and all the genders or no genders. And I don't see many people choosing that smaller Apple Watch anymore. Meanwhile, if you look at the smartwatch market, the current, quote, big Series 9, that's the one I wear, that's the one I think Casey probably should be wearing, the big one, relative to other smartwatches in the market, is actually fairly medium-sized. Many other smartwatches in the market are actually significantly bigger. And so what the Ultra's success, I think, showed Apple and showed the market is that, yes, a lot of people choose it because of those technical factors, but a lot of people also just like big watches. Big watches are in, especially smartwatches, big smartwatches. That is just in fashion right now. So I bet if Apple is truly getting rid of the smallest size and making them both bigger, I think that's not because they're abandoning the market for small watches. I bet it's more because the market abandoned theirs. The market probably moved on and has not been buying the small watch very much at all. And I think ultimately people of all wrist sizes have been choosing bigger smartwatches over the last few years way more than they used to. So I think this is just Apple responding to the market and wanting to serve where the demand actually is. They did the same thing with phones and phone sizes growing over time. This is they're doing the same thing with the watch. I think they're going to raise the sizes of both of them, and everybody will complain about it for about a week, and then we'll try them and be like, oh, this is nicer. Yep. And then it'll be fine. And people will buy them like crazy, especially the biggest one, way more than we think they will. So I think this is going to be totally fine if they increase the sizes of the watches a little bit. We'll all get used to it and it'll be fine.
All right. Hello, Future Marco. I guess do we want to do wish list? Because we've already kind of
integrated them. I mean, do you have anything else to add wish listy wise?
I don't think so. I think I did as well. So I'm inclined to say, what is our time?
We can do a couple last ATPs. Yeah.
All right. Let me scroll before you go. Okay. Goodbye, Future Marco.
Bye.
All right, let's do at least a little bit of Ask ATP if we can. PG&E Delenda Est. I love people who provide these kooky usernames and no real names. Anyways, Marco, it's not even Halloween, for goodness sakes. Marco, how hard is it to maintain server compatibility with clients that are still going to be on the last iOS 16 or below builds of Overcast? Are you doing that thing? I'm sure there's a term for it. Are you doing that thing where it's like something along the lines of api.overcast.fm/2/ yes, you know, endpoints? Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
Did I just ruin your answer then? I'm sorry.
No. Well, it is a good question, though, because like at some point I do end support for the really old API protocols. How hard it is to maintain server compatibility in general with old clients, if you just make a new copy of your API, you know, controller or functions or whatever, and just call this one, like I'm currently on version 6, from over time, you know, slow changes to it. It's really not that bad. The main problem comes when you have to do, like, significant changes to things like the server side schema, like how your data is stored, and like, so do you like build in compatibility layers? How long do you keep those over time? Does certain problems occur when older versions of the app sync that maybe like clobber changes from the new versions? Then do you accommodate that? Over time, that complexity grows, and how much you want to maintain it for a decreasing number of clients. Eventually that trade-off becomes not worth it, and you say, all right, you know what, you know, in a month I'm going to cut off support for iOS 12 or whatever, and, you know, because it's currently representing like 0.01% of my users, and I, you know, it's going to be too bad for those people, but, you know, it's been long enough. The downside of doing that, of course, is, you know, Overcast is a server-dependent app, and so if the servers stop supporting a certain client version, that version of the app does not work anymore. It will not get new updates. You cannot add new podcasts. You cannot download new podcasts. Like, you can't even log in. Like, it will totally break that client. So I try not to do that until those clients are very old. In this case, you know, the specifics of the new API for the rewrite, the protocol with which the clients speak to the server and vice versa has totally changed. It's way lighter on the servers. It's way more efficient. The old protocol was very hard on the servers. And so you would think I would have a pretty substantial incentive to end support soon for the old ones. But because the numbers drop off so fast for like how, like there's not like in, you know, a month or two, there's going to be a big chunk of those iOS 16 only people that fall off because they replace their phones. And so already I don't have the number in front of me, but I'm already like well into the 90% for the user base for iOS 17. And again, that's I expect it to be like, you know, above 95% probably after iOS 18 and the new phones launch. So even though the old protocol is way less efficient and way harder on the servers, I don't have much incentive to end its support anytime soon because it's going to be such a tiny percentage of the user base that's going to be holding on to it. So that'll probably be supported for a while. You know, we're talking probably years, multiple years, because again, there's not much reason to end it yet. Eventually there will be, but the protocol is mostly what has changed, not the data storage layer. And some of the things I'm doing, I'm trying over time to push more of the logic that was previously server-side logic, push more of it to the clients where possible, in part just to lighten the load on the servers, and in part because sometimes that's just way easier to do on the client, or I can offer better features if I do it client-side. So for instance, the current test flight build, I have fixed a problem with the episode limit not being enforced. I've had this option forever of, like, you know, you can limit a podcast to only keep the latest, you know, one or two or five episodes of that podcast. This feature, if I was launching a new podcast app today, I would never offer this feature. It is so tricky and problematic, and that has been enforced server side to date. This new test flight build enforces it client side, and that's part of why it's fixed for a lot of people, because doing it server side, because there's all sorts of differences. I'll get into a very brief diversion here. The problem is the way the servers have to deal with data in very different ways. They have to deal with scale in very different ways. So when you, as a user, when you subscribe to a podcast, what you see, suppose you subscribe to a new podcast that has 1,000 episodes in it, back in its feed, and you subscribe, you now have in your app 1,000 episodes that you don't have any history with. And then a new one comes out, and maybe you play that one. Well, to your client, that's 1,001 rows in a table, most of which have all zeros in them. And then, you know, you have then that latest one, you can mark that as your progress or your played or whatever. And then eventually you're deleted. On the server, if I added 1,000 rows to the table that keeps track of everyone's status of episodes, every time someone subscribed to a podcast at 1,000 episodes, it would dramatically overwhelm the data needs of those tables, of those databases and those stores. It would take way more space and be way heavier and way more expensive to host. And, you know, more servers, larger backups, like everything, data size affects cost substantially. So that would be very bad. So on the server, I do tricks like when you subscribe to a show, I assume that the state of everything that precedes your subscription in that feed is, you know, just you never played it, you never deleted it. It's deleted but not played. Like that's the default state of everything that precedes your subscription to a new podcast. If you then go back and listen to an old one, then of course I insert that row. So I keep that, but I have all these optimizations in place that, like, okay, I'm not going to add all 1,000 of those as new rows to this table, because again, that would blow up everything. That logic wreaks havoc with episode limiting, and it's been so tricky to get it right server side. That's why, and I even tried a couple years ago, I even let people opt into a beta of a new way to handle it, because I thought I finally had nailed it and taken care of all those cases and all the edges and all the weirdness that somehow would still be efficient and would still not store nearly as much as it had to. I tried so many different ways to do this, and I never got it quite right. So with the new way that the new app talks to the servers, I've developed yet more issues with doing that server side. So what I'm going to do is, once this version of this app is reasonably out there that does it all client-side, because again, client-side, it's way easier to do, because the client simulates all of that. Because the client has no, I don't care if I take another 5 kilobytes on your phone. So the client can have 1,000 rows in the database when you subscribe to a feed, because it's just keeping it locally. I don't care. It's a SQLite database. It's super light. So the client can do perfect limiting, because it has perfect information, whereas the server is simulating perfect information with a bunch of optimizations. So anyway, so what I plan to do is move that logic entirely to the client with the next release, and then over time, eventually tell the server to stop even trying to do that, to stop enforcing episode limits at all, because that will make a lot of things easier. It'll reduce this bug potential in the app, and you don't want the server trying to do it at the same time the app is doing it. So that's kind of my long-term plan here, is have the server stop enforcing that completely. When that happens, if you are still, say, on an old client, your episode limits will stop working. Like, if all of your Overcast devices that you're logged into, if none of them have the new version that does this, your episode limits will just slowly increase, and like things won't get automatically deleted once they pass that limit. And so things like that, like kind of weird drift, will start happening if you're still using a very old version of the API. That's another reason why, like, eventually it does make sense to retire them, because if they start, like, producing weird conditions or, like, things that are, could cause bugs for other clients, you know, you got to retire them then, or find a way to limit them. But for the most part, I'm because I'm moving more towards more stuff happening on the client, and the server side feature set is fairly fixed. I don't intend to really do much more server side, unless we get into things like, you know, transcriptions, but that's a whole other bag of worms. Because of all that, I expect the iOS 16 API to still work for a long time, to answer your question, in a very long way.
Mark Robinson writes, when a podcast says follow us on Apple Podcasts, it really helps the show. Does listening through Overcast do that as well? Does Apple register that follow in a way that counts and helps the show? Also, how does it actually help the show?
Listening through Overcast doesn't do anything to affect Apple Podcasts or its rankings, because Apple Podcasts does not know that you're listening in Overcast. Apple, if you subscribe to a podcast in Apple Podcasts, Apple does register that in some way, and it does help the show. It helps the show mainly in ranking it higher and possibly helping it get on certain top lists or ranked lists that are occasionally used for discovery in Apple Podcasts. Over time, I think they're using this less, in the sense that they're doing more kind of, you know, things you might like type of recommendations, rather than top list of new and noteworthy, you know, this week or whatever. So I think this is mattering less over time. But they historically have used new follows as a strong signal. I think possibly at some times, I think that was actually the only signal that would feed into, like, what shows up on their top hot list today. Because it is a pretty good signal overall, like how many new follows is a show getting. And for the record, I actually try not to have those kind of metrics in Overcast that are global like that, because it tends to reinforce, like, the rich get richer. So I've moved away from most of those over time. But that is, as far as I know, that is still part of how Apple Podcasts does recommendations and rankings.
Do we want to do High Future Marco? Do we want to do the next one, or do I think that could get involved? And also, to be honest, I didn't do my homework because it wasn't there when I was doing my homework. So I'm inclined to say, let's hunt and go to post show, but you tell me, John, how do you want to, or do you want to skip forward?
We can save that one because it is longer. We'll save it for next week.
Do you want to do the P list one, or do you want to just say the heck with it? And
no, we can just cut
let's go to post.
All right.
Thank you to our sponsor this week, Squarespace. Thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the member perks is ATP Overtime, a bonus topic every week just for members. This week's Overtime, we're talking about AI angst. There are some tricky things going on with the AI world, including authors suing Anthropic and some drama over at NaNoWriMo. We're talking about both those things in ATP Overtime. You can join to listen, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Do we have a post-show?
Looks like we have a couple of car things.
Post, I have my neutral post show that I suggested, but if Marco wants to do his, mine will keep.
Mine is short. So,
I personally will take pity on dying John, but I will do whatever.
Yeah, Marco, do yours. Mine is not time sensitive.
Well, I think we do both. I think mine is short, and we can lead into yours.
Actually, okay. That's right. Probably true. We could do that.
All right.
So we have a post show neutral this week. I think it's a combo platter of a couple of items, and I think we're going to start with Marco.
I'm not having a good time in neutral land right now.
Uh-oh.
Battery fault.
Yes. Yeah, so remember when that battery fault message popped up about a month ago?
Oh, I do. And I can't believe you haven't gotten the car service yet.
And I said at the time, you know, I'll get it serviced as soon as I'm back off the beach for the, you know, for the school year. Because, like, I'm not going to get it serviced while I'm still back and forth to the beach. Like, it's not, that's not going to help. It's going to be a pain in the butt and going, you know, driving all the way to Brooklyn for the Rivian Service Center. So I'm going to send you two photos in sequence here into the Slack group, and I'll try to put them as chapter art.
I have to say that this whole deal, like, with EVs, we don't have an established culture the way we do with internal combustion engine cars about the various levels of severity of things that can happen. And I know the culture is not consistent. You'll know people who drive their car with a check engine light on forever and ever. But most people who know something about cars, if the check engine light comes on, it's a sign that you should do something. Not like, I'll look at it in a few months, it's probably fine. Maybe it's fine, or maybe your engine's about to blow up, right? Whereas with EVs, they all have their own error messages, their own things, and there's no sort of universal equivalent of, like, you know, a light on the dashboard that we know, these ones are serious, you know, oil pressure drops to zero, stop the car, you know what I mean? Like, right. Things that we know about internal combustion. With EVs, it's like, I don't know, is that bad? Is a battery fault bad?
Right, and especially, you know, battery fault that only shows up when doing DC fast charging on a highway, and then I reboot the car a couple times and it doesn't show up anymore. Like, okay,
you don't have any like a frame of reference for how seriously should I take this?
Right, and so anyway, since I last reported on that, I have developed a few additional problems. So I mentioned, you know, the dramatically increased wind noise since getting the body shop to replace the side, which admittedly that's probably the body shop's fault, but there was wind noise before they did their work also. There was just a little bit less of it, but so, you know, wind noise, I got to get them to fix that. I had an increasing incidence of what seems like the auto steer system crashing. No, not literally, thank God, but I guess poor choice of words. But the auto steer sometimes will just turn off and make a bunch of noise, and it'll say highway assist system failure. And so that sounds like it crashed to me, but or some sensor broke. So I have to have them look at that. Also, I can no longer move the seat of the car. The driver's seat does not move.
That's not great.
Unless I am switching between the two profiles, the TIFF profile and the ME profile.
Hope you're happy with the profiles.
Yeah, it will not move. Like, none of the adjustments work. It is just stuck. Like, it refuses any other adjustment besides the profile switches. So if I wanted to, like, you know, oh, let me put it up a little bit. Nope, can't do that. If anybody else needs to drive my car, too bad. Like, if I need to move the seat back to, like, to get something out from under it, nope, too bad. Which, to me, that's actually probably, like, a safety issue that I should probably get fixed pretty immediately. And finally, I barely have air conditioning. The air conditioning
It
has almost completely gone out. It blows very weak air and goes through lots of times when the fan will just, like, kind of slow down and it'll blow totally hot air. And then it'll go back eventually and blow slightly cold air. But it's bad. Like, today was only in the high 70s and it couldn't keep up. Like, it was not a hot day. And it could not keep up, and it was blowing warm air most of the time. So the air conditioning, I basically have no air conditioning, or I have almost no air conditioning. So I created a support ticket in there. And, you know, the way you get service from Rivian is you go to their app and you, like, report your problems, and you can attach photos and whatever else. So I created the support ticket with all of these issues. I do find it very funny that apparently when you add 5 issues to a ticket, it says at the bottom, you've reached the max number of issues. Please submit these and start a new request. So
just say my car says otherwise,
right?
So I've reached the maximum number of problems with my Rivian that I can put in one service request. So I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll get in the service center within the next couple of weeks. You know, get this done. I'm a little scared because I have heard that this level 3 charging battery problem, I've found a couple of forum threads where people said it took them, like, months to figure it out. So I'm not loving that, but we haven't gotten there yet. We'll see what happens. So, okay, maybe I can get in the service center, you know, again, in maybe a week or two. Then I went to the next screen, which I'll send you now. These were the first available appointments.
Oh, no! Oh, that's not good at all.
The first available Rivian appointment in my entire region of New York is 10 weeks from now. November 13th.
That's undesirable.
Yes. So, and I checked, like, there's a couple other, like, Rivian service centers that are, like, you know, 100 miles away. And it's no better. It's the same. Like, they're all out
check,
to November.
You should check Richmond. I bet there's not a lot here.
I am not happy right now. Like, I'm starting to fall out of love with owning a first version car rapidly. And I knew when I bought it, I'm like, this is the first version of the R1S. Maybe I'll have some problems. I don't think I fully appreciated how much this sucks, that I now feel like my car is unreliable in some pretty key areas, and is losing things like air conditioning. Like, I'm pretty sure we solved that problem a long time ago. But no, air conditioning also broken, as well as the seat being too smart to move. I am really tired of beta testing cars. Like, whatever my next car is, I think it's, first of all, I think it might be sooner than I expect. But second of all, I think I just want to get something from a regular car company again, like an established car company that, like, I'm tired of the flux. And I think even though I love the features of this car in a lot of other ways, this rapidly erases those gains in my head. Like, having to deal with service, especially dealing with bad service, like what this is turning out to be, that, you know, to make a good car ownership experience, you need, the car needs to be good. It also needs to have almost no problems during ownership, especially when they're new. They really, this car is a year old. It should not be having any of these problems, let alone all of these problems, after 1 year. So there's, like, number one, a car mostly shouldn't have problems in its first few years, besides the basics of, like, you know, maintain the very basics of the car, like the brakes and the windshield wipers and stuff like that, and the tires, you know. That should be all you have to do for a car in the first couple of years. And so you shouldn't have these problems at all. But if you do have problems, you need the service and servicing infrastructure to be there and to be near you. Like, this is already, you know, having to drive to Brooklyn. Like, it's driving to the service center will take me an hour and a half on a good day. Like, and then I'm in, like, the worst part of Brooklyn where there's nothing around. It's all warehouses and it's terrible. And, like, God knows how many times I'm going to have to do that too. So it's already, like, a rough service situation. And, you know, to have the service then be backed all the way out 10 weeks when you ask for it, like, that's, I'm going back to a regular car company. Like, I can't.
But what would you buy? Like, no argument. And I am disappointed by this just peripherally, because you were so in love with that car when you first got it.
Yes.
And as much as I will always and forever make fun of the god awful color choice you made, like, it is a great car, but I don't think you have a lot of really good options, especially for a battery electric vehicle. Now, if you wanted to go back to, like, a Range Rover or Land Cruiser, whatever the hell it was you had before, then maybe. But if you're trying to go battery electric, what could you possibly get?
Well, that's what I was going to say. When the Land Rover is the more reliable option, you know you're in trouble.
Especially because, like, Land Rovers aren't super great on their service end either, but at least they have, like, you know, dealers everywhere that you can go to. Like, I got mine serviced once and it was fine. Like, it was, you know, totally fine. I think I'd be looking probably at, like, probably BMW again, or maybe even Polestar, but that's also a little bit too new. I think I would have the same problems with Polestar.
No, but what of these cars? Like, I don't think there's anything battery electric that either of these companies sell that would work for the beach, right?
Oh, well, that's the thing. I'm going to shortly stop needing that, because I'm going to shortly stop qualifying for my permit and lose the permit.
So, that's a bummer for other reasons, but
you don't have to get regular cars then. You don't have to get these SUVs anymore.
Right. So I that's why, like, I might be in the market, you know, maybe in 6 months or something. I might be in the market for something that is smaller, and or at least, like, you know, one of the options I'm looking at, the BMW iX, which I think is actually a very attractive option. It's not an attractive vehicle, but it is it's a very attractive option. Looking at, you know, there's, you know, Hyundai stuff, there's, you know, Volvo stuff, there's a bunch of things. Many of them have the first year problem, or, like, the first couple of years problem. And again, I think I'd be looking at maybe something a little more established. The really sad thing is, I really would not, I don't think, buy a Tesla right now, like, for lots of political reasons. That just feels very bad to me. But I see why people do, because when you look at the numbers of just like how much range does it offer and then what are you paying to get that car, Tesla is still way ahead of everybody. Like, their cars get such longer range than almost everyone except Lucid. And
they claim longer range, but they're also one of the most distant from their claims. So I would
no, but I had Teslas. They're pretty, like, yeah, they're,
I know,
they're a little BSC.
There are cars out there now that are claiming less than Tesla. They just get the same range, right? So you can't go by the numbers that are on the package.
Sure, but yeah, I think I'm gonna like. Well, let me see what happens with the Rivian, but I feel like I can't depend on it to, like, I'm going to take a long trip soon, and I feel like, can I depend on it to get there? I'm going to get there without air conditioning, but, you know, which is already a problem, and I probably can't have any other place service it, because it's probably all special and proprietary, and, like, so, like, can anybody else replace the air conditioning, whatever? Probably not. I don't know. This is why, like, I'm falling off the Rivian train really fast right now, because I'm having all these problems pile up over the last couple of months that are now going to be difficult to get fixed. Like, that's
You got to wait to get all this fixed before you can even like trade in or resell this thing, probably too.
Well, it depends on how I'm doing.
Just don't let the buyer listen to this podcast. No.
Yeah, right.
I wouldn't do a private sale. I would do a dealer thing or something. But yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so there might be some turbulence there in the next few months. We'll see. Hopefully it can last longer than that.
I'm really sorry to hear that. And what you said a moment ago, that you're not sure if it can reliably get you to your destination.
Because it almost the didn't. Moment, I was almost stranded on the last trip I took.
Yeah, no argument. The moment any of my cars have gotten to that point where it's no longer an inconvenience, but a genuine concern that you might not make it, the moment that happens, I'm out. I need a new car, even if it's a new used car, that's fine. But I need something different, because I cannot. Well, maybe cannot is a bit dramatic, but I refuse to be in a situation that if I need to get somewhere in my car, I am rolling the dice more than you always are as to whether or not I'll actually get there. And at that point, I'm out. So if you're me, you're already looking for something new, and it doesn't even matter if you can get this into a service center before November. It's already the nail's in the coffin. You're done.
Really? Like, because honestly, I mean, unfortunately, like if that happens. I got the early pre-order pricing on it, so like I actually I looked up roughly what the resale value of it would be, and like I would not be losing that much at all from what I paid a year ago, so it actually would not be that bad. But honestly, I'm thinking that direction, because in 3 days I'm driving a few hundred miles upstate, and so I can't really take Tiff's i3 conveniently. And also, she needs it. Like, she's not coming. I'm driving to go see Goose in concert. So there's no way Tiff's going to that. So I'm driving a few hundred miles in 3 days, and I need my car to work. And that's like to already know that. Okay, I'm not going to have any air conditioning probably on the trip. That sucks enough. But like to not even know, like, when I have to plug in somewhere, like, is it going to charge? Maybe. Is something else going to go wrong with it? Maybe. Like, I don't know. I'm feeling very bad about this right now.
Yeah, honestly, if it were me, there is no question I would be going and renting a car. And I know
I
know it turns your stomach to think about, probably renting a car, but I know it turns your stomach to consider a gasoline automobile, but it is okay to slum it with us regular humans for the purpose of one weekend. That's
one of the latest Honda hybrids. I think you might enjoy those, because Honda finally switched to the system where basically the gasoline engine is charging the battery and the battery is running the electric motor that turns the wheels most of the time. And that will be a more familiar experience to you. Oh, it feels like a not very fast EV most of the time with some additional noise that I don't understand. You might like it.
Why would I want that?
Because it'll be reliable and it'll get you there, and it'll get better mileage than a plain old gas car.
I'm like, this
50,
is
50 miles per gallon in a Honda that you can get fixed anywhere that will get you to your destination no matter what.
I don't think you need to buy anything, but I do think you need to rent something for this trip to go see Goose.
That's honestly, I'm thinking about renting something, but like that to rent a car for it's, I'm going to be gone for like 3-4 days. That's $600 or something. Like it's not a small amount of money.
It's not that bad at all. We
in
rented
New York,
a minivan.
It might be.
Well, okay, that's fair. We rented a minivan for a week, and I think it was like $300 or $400, and that was a week, and it was unlimited miles, et cetera, et cetera. Now, granted, we are in Podunk, Richmond, Virginia. We are not in effectively New York City, but I think it'd be more affordable than you expect if you're willing to slum it with a regular human car rather than some like Tesla or some other weirdo BEV or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, you do you. You're a grown ass man, but that's what I would do.
I think, like, you know, I certainly feel like a fool. I felt like a fool, like, you know, driving around a dented truck for, you know, a few months or whatever, or weeks, whatever that was. I would feel extra foolish renting a car because I can't trust mine to drive a few hundred miles reliably.
No, I wouldn't feel foolish about that personally. I get what you're saying, and I think foolish is not the word I would use. I would feel dejected that it's gotten to this point, but I wouldn't feel foolish at all. But you're doing what you can to make what should be an enjoyable weekend enjoyable. And I love you like a brother. Well, no, in a better way than that. I love you, but I don't think it's a far stretch for you to throw money at a problem to fix it. So I think this is right in your wheelhouse. This is what I would do.
Yeah, but what's then, like, when I have to drive to Thanksgiving in, you know, about 11 weeks.
Like, that's future Marco's problem.
And then Christmas that's after not, that. And like, it's, I need
that's
my
future
car
Marco's
work.
Problem.
I need, like, I can't. Ugh. I'm unreasonably angry at this.
No, this is what I'm saying.
Right,
I think I'm not doing you favors because I'm wholeheartedly in agreement with you. It's time to sell the car. Like, unless you can get it fixed by some miracle in the next week or two and you don't have a series of further problems, it's time to sell the car. Full stop. Like, I hate that. I hate that that's the case because I was there with you. I saw with my eyes how happy that car made you. It's even after I broke it for the first of what turned out to be many times. But I saw how happy that car made you. It does not give me pleasure to say this to you. This is not the normal, like, ATP ribbing. Like, I yeah. genuinely think as your friend, you need to sell that car because it is forever tainted. It has its scarlet letter. It is forever tainted in your mind. And I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all.
We could always get version 2 of that car where they consolidated the 17 control units down to 2 or whatever.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. It's an option.
Yeah, but the colors are so much worse in the version 2.
Oh, here we go. Are they really worse? Yeah. Now I'm coming back to ATP ribbing. Are they really worse, Marco? Are they really... all right. Well, I'm sorry. Please keep us updated with how this turns out, both in a friendly way and because I think it'll be good for the show way.
But... Yeah, that's the main reason you should try to take the Rivian, because whatever happens, it'll be a good story.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So breaking news literally today, I believe the embargo or the written embargoes have dropped with regard to the Volvo EX90. I'd seen some
we're not going to do this one. It's too late. We got to move on.
Oh, I see how
what?
It is. You
yeah.
you realize
Marco
if I
said
was
he has
sick,
a short one and then went for like 20 minutes. It's time.
Have you met him? Also,
I'm just saying
I'm
it's fine.
Sick,
mine will keep till next week.
Yes, oh but every God. Time I'm sick, you motherfuckers keep me up for like 3 hours.
You know, it's not like I didn't say there was an after show. That was a substantial after show.
I'm mostly grumbling because you bastards have done this to me 1,000 times. Otherwise, I think you're right.
It's just when you're a little bit tired, not that you like have 102 fever or something.
All right. What's the next step? What do we do next? We do titles. Is that right?
Yeah, titles next, and then
God,
we
so
do
lost.
Overtime.
Good God! And I'm not sick. I'm just lost. Giant Phone Tourist is very good.
I have a favorite. I suggested it. Too Smart to Move.
What was that about?
That's Marco describing the seats in his car.
I still
and it could also be described the entire car, that it has become too smart
true.
To move.
I think I prefer Giant Phone Tourist. I would not veto Too Smart to Move.
Yeah, I'm good with Too Smart to Move. I think that's the best one.
All right. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
It's so frustrating. It's like... It will move to toggle the profile, so I know it's not a physical problem. Like, it will physically move the seat. It just won't listen to adjustments to the
control unit number 14 is on the fritz.
Right? Seriously. Actually, when I first got my BMW, I forget specifically what the problem was for the life of me, but when I first got the BMW, there was something wrong, I think, with the comfort access, which is the thing that they call the keyless entry, and it ended up that they replaced, this was back when it was still under warranty, they replaced like an entire control unit in the footwell or something like that. Gosh, I wish I remember the name of that darn thing, but it was an entire computer basically that they had to replace to fix the stupid keyless entry. It was bananas. It was a sign of things to come with that car.
Yeah, I think I just want to get back to leasing. Like, just be dumb. Like, get rid of all this risk with, like, oh, what happens if I dent a panel? Then if it's worth a bunch less, you know, get rid of all the risk of all that. Get rid of all the weird servicing problems of new companies. Like, I just, ugh. Yeah, I might be doing
so. Maybe we should save this for another after show or something. But if you were to get something tomorrow, what do you think you would get? The BMW i, whatever?
The iX. I think I might. I mean, I've never been in one.
My guy.
The person in the chat room says the iX is no good.
So it basically said it doesn't drive very well. But honestly, that does not line up with most of the reviews I've seen, including long-term reviews. People seem to love it.
But why are you looking at SUVs if you don't need a sand car? Why are you still doing this?
Fair. I mean, so a couple of reasons I would be looking at SUVs. One is just cargo space. We do use it frequently. Although I don't need it to be as big as, like, the Rivian is way bigger than I need to be cargo wise.
Isn't there like a cool electric wagon? Didn't I just post that to the Neutral Channel recently?
Maybe. I mean, I'll certainly look at it. But one of the things is that I have a lot of, like, weird leg sciatic problems in a lot of sedans if I use them for very long trips.
So normally what I'll do is I'll
crank the seat really so it's at its highest height for the seat pan, and then try to, like, you know, lean, like, the front part under your knees, try to tilt that part down a bit so that way you're sitting, like, on, like, a slight flat or slope down if you can. Most sedans don't have the height to even let you do that, or it's a very limited range. So I do want to try, like, I was recently on a trip where I rented a sedan, and it was fine for the trip. And there were a couple of, like, you know, two-hour drives on it. But so that was fine for a short drive like that. So maybe I can do a sedan again. I certainly want to look at it. But the other thing is, if I did a sedan, I would require it to be a hatchback, because I loved the Model S in terms of cargo capacity for that. Like, to have that as a hatchback was great. And if Tesla didn't suck so bad politically as a company, I would honestly consider a Model X at this point. But unfortunately, I just can't bear it. Like, I'm not going to go to Tesla. Like, I can't make myself do that.
This is 100% the correct answer, but oh my gosh, you're going to get so many,
like,
grumpy fanboys.
Honestly, I think I would go to gas before I go to Tesla. Like, that's how much I don't want to support that.
And I have to say that despite Tesla being on generation umpteen of their cars, their reliability is still not up to where it should be. It's not as bad as it was, obviously, with their first generation products, but still, the stories keep coming out for people who bought their cars, like, this year. It's still not great.
Yeah, it seems like, so, like, you know, my first Tesla was 2016, I believe.
It sounds right from what
and
I remember.
It was the Model S. It was like the 1.5 version of the Model S or something. The Model S had already been out for a few years by then, and so they actually that car was pretty reliable. I had to get the door handles fixed a couple times. The stupid pop out door handles. I had to get those fixed, I think, twice. But for the most, and I think the screen, I had to, like, it was, like, discoloring around the screen, so I had to get that replaced. But other than that, those were minor issues. They were both fixed. And then the second Model S I had, I was leasing them. The second one I had, besides the fact that Tesla totally blew up the lease and didn't cancel the first one and was double charging me, and it took months to eventually had to get them to pay me, like, it was a mess that took months to resolve. But the second Model S I had zero problems. Like, it was fine. I had no issues with it whatsoever. You know, because even the first one, again, the first one was a few years into that product existing. The second one was then 3 more years into the product existing. And so it was rock solid. But that was like right when the Model 3 was starting. And I think now it's a very different company in the sense that they're doing such different volumes now, way more volume than what they're doing now than they used to. And I think a lot of the quality problems that we see are because they're just doing so much volume and they're not very consistent. And we've seen that be a problem with Tesla a lot since the Model 3 came out. Like, a lot of them sell and they're fine, but you're rolling the dice. Like, sometimes they're just trash and you don't know what you're going to get. I really don't like where they've taken the Model S. It seems like what Tesla is very good at is making a really good core of an EV, really good battery, really good powertrain, but in order to keep the price somewhat reasonable, they have to then put a really minimal, cheap car interior on top of that. And so they're really good at that. And the Model 3 and the Model Y are massively successful in the market because that's what most people want. The Model 3 and Model Y are not very luxurious inside at all. They are very nice drivetrains with basically, like, you know, a value car interior stuck on top of them. And that is probably the right move for most people most of the time. But the Model S is supposed to be a higher end car. with like a nicer interior and nicer features. And when you look at them, the more recent Model S's, they've cheaped it out so much compared to the past ones. I actually really don't like them. I think they do not look like their price at all. And I think other car companies are doing a better job in that price range at making nicer seeming cars. So I don't like where Tesla is now, both politically, of course, but also even the products. Like, I think the best Tesla to buy overall is the Model Y, because that's the one that, like, and that, there's a reason why I believe that's their top seller by a good deal, because you're not getting much more in the Model S than you do with the Model Y, I think, and that's why everyone's choosing it. But anyway, I don't know. I got to look and see, like, you know, like, should I look at the Audi e-tron? Should I look at, you know, what other things? Like, I haven't been looking. I don't really
look at Audi, BMW, Volvo. They all make good EVs that you can.
Why not the Taycan, whatever it's called?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
It's absurdly expensive.
They do make a wagon version of that, but it's ugly.
I wouldn't probably go back to the, like, large, low sedan shape, like the Model S or the Lucid, even if it was... Lucid has very compelling ranges. They have terrible trunks, and they are a very new company.
The trunks aren't terrible. They're very big.
They're not hatchbacks.
You're right. They're not hatchbacks, but like if you combine the frunk and the trunk in the Lucid Air, it's a huge amount of space. The frunk is gigantic.
I don't know. Anyway, so I want to... I'm interested in trying to find things that are, like, a little bit taller than those low sedans so I can try to get a good leg position, like, with the seat panel.
Well, Lucid is coming out with an SUV, but, of course, it would be the first generation of that car, so maybe
I'm not doing that. And even, like, you know, like, the Polestar 3, I think? That's the one that's coming out now-ish? The early reviews of that are excellent. They're very, very strong. But, again, it's the first generation from a relatively new company. And, yeah, I know it's kind of Volvo, but, like, I just... And I honestly, unlike you, John, I think Polestars look great.
I like how Polestars look as well. I just don't like specifically the Polestar 2, and it stands out because I like pretty much all of the Polestars.
That's my favorite one.
No, that's the one I don't like.
So I don't know. There's the Ioniq 5. Like, there's a whole bunch that I want to look at if I'm going to replace my car. I think, Casey, you're right. I probably should replace my car. I just really, like... It bothers me so much to replace a car after a year. I know I've just done this with the sand, but like,
I totally get it.
And even though I wouldn't lose much money on it again because of my wonderful pre-order pricing, I would really not lose much on it. But it just irks me.
You think
me.
The trade-in is not going to notice your $20,000 repair?
I think they'll see that it has a report in Carfax. I don't think they're going to know, you know, how big of a report it is. Mm-hmm. But I think ultimately, like, I've done some math and done some estimates, and even factoring in that they'll give me less for it because they'll see that in Carfax, even factoring that in, I'm still not going to be behind by much after a year. So
I hope they don't try to adjust the seat.
Yeah, right. Oh, God. I didn't think about
that. Just going to drive this around to the back and,
I'll luck out because, like, especially, like, if I'm trading it into a dealer, how many Rivians have they used? Like, they'll probably just assume they're not doing it right.
They just haven't figured it out, you know.
Oh, God. So, yeah, we'll see. I might be in something else sometime in the next few months, but I don't want. By the way, I did, while we were talking, I did price out rental cars from the local Long Island renting places. And even the cheapest one is over $200 for this time span. It's of like 4 days.
I don't think that's unreasonable.
And that's like the economy. Days. That's like the little crap box. Like the one, like the probably the smallest one or the cheapest one that I would actually get would be like the full size sedan option, like the Toyota Camry or similar. That's like in the 250 range, like where you get up there quick. So I don't know. We'll see. I could rent a Maxima for $313. I bet those are not as good as I remember.
All right. So as always, it turns out that my memory is indeed trash. The minivan that we rented for a week with the Allstate sorry that your car exploded pricing was $715.77.
There you go.
That's a minivan. Minivan.
No, yeah. I mean, it's. I still think it's. I think $200 to $300 is perfectly reasonable, and maybe even. $400. However, it is certainly more expensive than I thought when we were talking on the show, so my apologies.
I could rent a Maserati or similar for $627.
Oh, yes. That's definitely reliable. Definitely do that one.
I'm impressed that's even an option. Like, that's pretty good.
They said or similar, so you get like a Fiat.
Yeah, for real.
Right.
All right, we should probably do some overtime so John can go to bed.
Yeah. All right. Let me cut off the live people. Thank you, live people, for being live people. We will continue with the bootleg.